FM podcast.
So I spoke with Jason Te Kare, who is a New Zealand, born in Auckland, in fact, born and bred actor. He is well known for his work in A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Pop-Up Globe as Oberon. He's also been in The Prince of Morocco and The Merchant of Venice. For 10 years, Jason worked as a drama producer for Radio New Zealand. And he is heavily involved with Te Oro in Glen Innes, the music and arts facility, which focuses on local youth. But Jason still has roots in the neighbourhood where he grew up, obviously Glen Innes, and he's a son of well-known GI identity Barbara Te Kare. So I spoke with him about his latest work, Selfish, and we talked a little bit about his childhood and what's informed this new work of his.
So we all kind of ended up venturing along together along this path, looking at the systems failing not only Māori, but New Zealanders, which quite often all those different systems, the education system, the health system, the housing system, you know, the mental health system, all failing New Zealanders, and prison is where these system failures, mm-hmm. or the people who these systems have failed, all end up. So yeah. It was such fertile ground for storytelling, mm-hmm. but the exciting thing was the way that Miriamma and Rob had chosen to tell the story, because they were really trying to challenge themselves as actors, but they use multi-character, so they play all the characters, they use singing, they use dance, they use kapahaka, they use Shakespeare, they use this awesome. Massive gambit, and it's a huge ask of the actors to perform. But at the end of the day, and I know this from my own experience of creating theatre, if a work gets too heavy, almost too earnest, an audience stops listening.
Right.
So it's it's where theatre lies in the present situation, where your job is still to entertain your audience, to take them on a journey, and you've got to entice them. Otherwise, they'll switch off. If it gets too dark,
too heavy,
they just don't stop engaging.
Right.
So. Yeah, so at the same time, we try to keep them entertained.
Yeah.
And we play with this device where you get to go into the inside of the inmates, into their head, awesome. The things they dream about, they fantasize about, and really sometimes some of the nightmares they kind of escape from. So, it's
quite a
great
device. Different look at inmates, perhaps, which is very cool. Sort of going back to that, to the failings that you wanted to, show and tell in your story, having grown up in a halfway house and, experiencing and seeing firsthand these failings, explain to me specifically what were the failings of the government at the time, and have we changed much now? Has there been much growth?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's changed, but I know back then, and what's really come to light is state care of especially young Māori men as it's come out is just been straight out abusive. You know, you've had young men who have been through trauma then taken away by state care to be put into more trauma, and then at the age of 17, I think, is they're set free into society, expected to be able to look after and care for themselves. So that's quite a well-known one. Of course, the mental health system probably was at the same level of understanding as the state care system, in that people were locked up for the shortest thing, the smallest thing. Not that depression's small, but if someone was suffering, if a mother was suffering from postnatal depression?
Right, depression, yeah.
Of course, there was quite a simple kind of approach to those kinds of understandings. What else? The educational system was failing Māori at a massive rate in the 80s and 70s. The chance for further training, for university entrance, were pretty small. The expectation of Māori from the 50s, 60s, 70s into the 80s was pretty poor. You look at the work of groups like Ngā Tamatoa, we're just trying to get things like the language recognised by the government of the day was a huge fight. You know, so these things do not go away over time.
Mm.
And we're moving forward as a country and as a culture, but there are things where we're still quite static. And I think sometimes the expectation is that these things disappear overnight.
Mm.
They don't. They're going to take decades to fix.
Mm. For people that, you know, come and see the show, what do you want them to take away from it? What's the, you know, the purpose of the show?
Well, for me, it's about starting a conversation. It's so easy to write these people off. And I mean these people, I mean the characters off as a lost cause, as people who have just made bad choices, as, you know. And to be honest, it's a complex issue. There are layers, there are layers and layers of issues, and there is no easy fix. So the play is intentionally not an easy piece to, well, I ask the audience to work. It
right.
is built like a thriller.
Mm.
You are asked to, you are expected to work, to listen, to
engage.
Really work and engage, yes. But but part of that approach is not only reflecting the issues around incarceration, but it's also to do with beginning a conversation. Even if the conversation after seeing the work is about working out what the plot line was, why characters did what they did, what the twist was, did it work? Even if the conversation starts there, I'm hoping the conversation then builds into the larger issues around incarceration. You know, it's been well advertised that our prison population has hit over 10,000. And it's nice to have a government who is looking to find solutions about that.
Mm. Rehabilitate rather than incarcerate.
Unfortunately, though, I think in order to sell this idea of rehabilitation, the unfortunate thing is we've gone about it by saying, well, it's a money-saving thing, so we don't have to build another prison.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a bit of a cop-out. I understand the approach in selling it that way because there are many people with very strong points of view. I mean, if you've seen the 13th, the documentary, that the vote-selling approach of getting tough on crime, getting tough on crime. And then one of the great things about looking into this, creating this work, is the science says getting tough on crime does not stop crime.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, sometimes because of their upbringing, people who get involved and end up in prison do not make choices. They do good choices. They do not weigh up the consequence of their action, which is why they're in prison.
Mm.
So toughening the consequence is not going to change the action. The science says they are more likely to think about the likelihood of being caught than they are the consequence of the action.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, this is the approach. But once the action is made and they are, then you're right, rehabilitation surely is the key.
Has to be the most important thing.
It's the thing that, you know, is going to benefit both sides. The way I kind of really feel about it at the moment is it's a war. There's a war happening, and it's happening in all societies. And compassion is the thing that is being slaughtered.
Mm.
Unless, and I guess us as the side of the war, of the two sides warring, who are supposed to be making the right choices, we're the ones who need to come to the table with compassion first, so that we can rehabilitate these people who have made bad choices to have come out back into society and hopefully make good choices.
Mm. So you want a discourse around solutions?
It's got to start with a conversation. It's got to start with people challenging each other on their thoughts and their ideas around the issues.
And can people expect a happy ending? Or is it...
Well,
does it leave and make you just think and talk?
Yeah, well, it's intentionally left to the audience to kind of discuss.
Yeah.
But I think all you have to do is look at the issue and ask yourself, is there a happy ending at the moment?
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.